rumor and internet weirdness that we're trying to cut through. But this Sharma guy is claiming to have shot down an alien spacecraft and captured its crew.
Some of the Moogs who were after 8, probably, I reply.
Right. Took them alive and everything. Even though it happened in India, it should still be national news. But it's not.
Someone's keeping a lid on it.
Mark's trying to make contact with Sharma. He wants to run the story on They Walk Among Us, hopefully expose the Moogs to the general public.
Huh, I say, rubbing the back of my neck and thinking out loud.
Might help rally some support if things get bad. How bad are things going to get, John?
I swallow hard. Even though I used my healing legacy shortly after battle, I can still feel the general's fingers clenched around my throat.
I don't know,
I say, not sure why I'm hiding Adam's theory on imminent invasion from Sarah. I guess
maybe I'm still trying to protect her.
I quickly change the subject. How's Mark doing, anyway?
He's doing fine, Sarah replies. He's changed a lot.
How so?
Sarah hesitates. It's hard to explain.
I don't dwell for very long on the present state of Mark James. It isn't what I want to talk about.
Really, after nearly dying this afternoon, all I want is to hear Sarah's voice.
I miss you, I say.
I miss you too, Sarah replies. After a long day of fighting alien invaders and unraveling international conspiracies, I wish we could just snuggle up on that old couch in my basement and watch a movie.
That makes me laugh, the feeling bittersweet as I picture the kind of normal life Sarah and I might be leading if we weren't trying to save the world.
Soon,
I tell her, trying to sound confident.
I hope so,
she replies. I sense movement behind me and turn around to find Sam standing on the ruined porch of Adam's house. He motions for me to come inside.
Sarah, I've got to go,
I say, feeling reluctant to hang up the phone.
We've been checking in with each other every 8 hours like we planned, and I feel a sense of relief every time I hear her voice.
Every time I disconnect,
I start thinking about the next time.
The time when she won't call.
Be careful, okay? Things might be getting pretty heavy soon. Things aren't already heavy? She asks. You be careful, too. I love you.
I say goodbye to Sarah and tilt my head at Sam. He looks
almost excited,
like he's gotten some good news in the last 5 minutes.
What's up?
Come down, he says. We figured something out.
I climb onto what's left of the porch after this afternoon's skirmish, and follow Sam through the half-sunken doorway into the living room. The interior of the house matches the exterior. The perfect idea of human suburbia. Except the furniture looks like it was arranged exactly as seen on the pages of a catalog. There's absolutely no sense of it being lived in. I try to imagine what it was like for Adam growing up here. Try to picture him bashing little Pikin action figures together on the floor. And just can't do it. At the back of the living room is a massive metal door, secured by a series of locks operated by a keypad covered in Mogadorian symbols. The door is the one thing that breaks the suburban illusion, and it's actually kind of surprising to me that the Moogs didn't try hiding it behind a bookcase or something. I guess they never thought their enemies would make it this far. The door is already open, unlocked by Adam earlier, and it's through there that Sam and I descend into the tunnels beneath Ashwood Estates. We walk down a long metal staircase, the phony hominess above immediately replaced by sterile stainless steel and buzzing halogen lights. The labyrinthine network of tunnels beneath Ashwood is much more in keeping with my idea of the Mogadorians. Functional and cold. It's not quite as sprawling down here as the hollowed-out mountain in West Virginia, but it definitely puts Dulcie Base to shame. I wonder how long it took them to carve all this out. The Moog's tunneling into the Earth during those years I was on the run with Henri, expanding their reach without us even realizing it. There's a jagged and long crack in the wall that starts about halfway down the steps and runs ahead deeper into the tunnels. Sam reaches out to drag his hand along it, coating his fingers with concrete dust. We're sure this place isn't going to collapse, right?
Adam doesn't think so, Sam replies, clapping his hands clean, the noise echoing. It creeps me out down here, though. Seriously claustrophobic.
Don't worry. We won't be staying long.
We pass other cracks as we navigate the twisting hallways, places where the foundation shifted, broken sections of concrete grinding against each other. The damage was caused the last time Adam was here, when he unleashed his earthquake legacy to rescue Malcolm. There are some hallways where the ceilings have outright collapsed. Down the hall, we pass by a large, well-lit room that looks like it might have been a laboratory at one point. Lots of nozzles and levers and work tables, but no equipment. Everything must have gotten destroyed in Adam's attack, and the Moog salvage team never got the chance to replace it. Next to the lab, we pass a row of oppressive 8x8 rooms with thick doors made from bulletproof glass. Cells. All of them currently unoccupied.
The archives are up here, Sam tells me. Dad's been in there nonstop. The Moog's recorded everything.
We stop by a small room, almost like an office, with a huge bank of monitors. Malcolm sits behind the room's single computer terminal, bleary-eyed from watching who knows how many hours of footage. On screen, a Mogadorian scout speaks directly into the camera.
It has been 3 days since we leaked rumors of a Loric presence in Buenos Aires, the scout reports. There has yet been any sign of guard, but surveillance continues.
Malcolm pauses the video when he notices us, rubbing his eyes. Find anything useful? I ask. Malcolm shakes his head and pulls up a list of files on the computer. He brushes a finger down the touchscreen, and the files begin in an endless scroll. There are thousands of them, and all their titles are in Mogadorian.
From what I can gather, this is almost 5 years' worth of Mogadorian intelligence, Malcolm explains. I'd need an entire team to go through it all, even with Adam translating these titles, which are basically just dates and times. It's hard to figure out where to begin.
Maybe we can hire some interns, Sam suggests, then tugs my arm. Come on, we gotta see Adam.
Do what you can, I tell Malcolm before Sam drags me away. Even the smallest bit of information might help.
A few more steps down the hall, and we reach the room Adam described as the control center. The room is pretty much undamaged, so it's where we set up shop. The walls are covered in monitors, security camera footage from Ashwood streaming over some, but also video feeds from other places, including one hacked security camera outside the barricaded John Hancock Center. Beneath the monitors are a row of computers, not exactly user-friendly since all the keys are in Mogadorian. I put my hands on my hips and survey this place, watching the camera feeds that not too long ago would have been trained on me. It feels strange to be on the other side. Like Sam, this place makes me uneasy.
Are we safe here? I ask. All these cameras? There aren't any pointed back at us?
I've disabled them, Adam replies.
He's in a swivel chair at one of the computers, typing out a string of commands. He turns around to face me.
Using the General's authorization, I have sent a code back to the Mogadorian Command in West Virginia, reporting that the salvage team uncovered a toxic chemical leak. It'll take some time to clean up. They'll assume the failed cameras have something to do with the salvage team's work.
How much time does that buy us?
A couple of days? A week? Adam replies. They'll become suspicious when the General doesn't check in. but we should slip through the cracks for a while.
What do we look for in the meantime?
Your friends,
Adam replies.
In fact, I believe I've already found them.
Yeah, Florida, I say. We already knew that.
No, he found them. Like, exactly, Sam replies, grinning at me. That's why I came to get you. Check this out.
Sam points at one of the screens. This one displaying a map of the United States. The map is covered in triangles of various sizes. There's a small triangle over our location, along with a few similar-sized indicators scattered throughout the country. There are bigger triangles glowing on top of population centers. New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston. All these cities are marked on the map. The biggest triangle of all is to the west of us, right around where the Moog's mountain base is hidden in West Virginia.
This is a... Sam looks over at Adam. What do you call this thing?
Tactical asset overview, Adam replies. It shows where my people have ongoing operations.
They're massing in the major cities, I say, studying the map.
Yeah,
Adam replies grimly.
In preparation for the invasion.
Let's not focus on the I word right now, okay?
Sam says.
Look at this.
Sam has plugged the tablet displaying the location of the other guard into one of the computers. He hands it to me, and my eyes immediately shoot to Florida. My heart skips a beat. There's only one blinking dot on the map. It takes me a moment to realize that the four dots symbolizing each of the remaining guard have actually gotten so close together that they perfectly overlap. They're almost on top of each other, I say, all four of them.
Yep, Sam replies, taking back the tablet. And look at this.
He holds the tablet up next to the map of Mogadorian activity. The four dots perfectly line up with one of the smaller orange triangles in Florida. The Moogs have them, I say, gritting my teeth.
Adam, is that a base of some kind?
A research station, he replies. The records show there was some genetic experimentation being done there. It isn't the kind of place we'd normally keep prisoners, especially not guard.
Why even take prisoners at this point? Sam asks. I mean, I get Cetricus Rai some weird thing for Ella, but the others?
They aren't prisoners, I say, hitting Sam on the arm in excitement as this dawns on me. The others are up to something. They're on the attack.
I'm working on getting us a visual of the base,
Adam says, his fingers racing across the keyboard.
How are you going to do that?
I ask. I sit down in the swivel chair next to Adam and watch his hands flick across the Mogadorian keyboard. Whatever he's doing seems almost like second nature.
I've locked down a scout ship, so they won't be able to operate it. That was the easy part. Accessing and isolating its onboard surveillance while still keeping the craft inoperable is proving trickier.
You're hacking into a ship?
Sam asks, leaning over the back of Adam's chair. I watch the monitor directly in front of Adam crackle with static. How does that help us?
This control room is a nerve center, John, Adam explains,
taking a moment away from typing to gesture around.
Information from all the other bases feeds to here. It is just a matter of accessing it.
Accessing it how?
Hunting the Lorik for so many years has made my people paranoid to ever miss a potential lead. Every operation is recorded. There's surveillance everywhere.
Adam strikes a key with a triumphant flare.
Even aboard our own ships.
The monitors above flicker briefly and then display grainy footage of a runway in the middle of a swamp.
If the guard are nearby, we might be able to see them. Adam explains.
If they're not invisible, I say, squinting at the monitor. Beneath the camera, a handful of Mogadorians look frustrated as they yank engine parts from the scout ship's hull.
They clean these parts, reattach them, and, when nothing happens, start taking apart something else.
What are they doing? Sam asks.
Trying to fix what I've done,
Adam replies excitedly, seeming pleased that he's outsmarted his people.
They assume engine failure, not automated systems override. It will take them a while to catch on.
Another Mogadorian, this one wearing an impressive-looking uniform similar to the general's, approaches them. He yells at the mechanics, then walks off-screen in a huff.
Does the camera move? I ask.
Of course.
Adam hits a button, and the camera begins to scan to the side, following the dressed-up Mogadorian. At first, there isn't much to see except pavement and, in the distance, some swampland. However, after a short walk, the dressed-up Mogadorian disappears into an airplane hangar.
Do you think they're in there? I ask.
This camera should be equipped with heat vision, if I can figure out how to access it, Adam replies,
tentatively tapping a few of the keys in front of him. Before Adam can figure it out, Five walks through the hangar doors. Even though I'd guessed he was a traitor from Ella's vision, I'd been holding on to a foolish hope that it wasn't true. Or, dark as it might seem, that Five was the one killed in battle. But there he is, in a rumpled Mogadorian uniform, and with a bandage covering his right eye. I can hear Sam suck in a breath. He's stunned. The only part of my vision that I hadn't told anyone about was seeing Five. Not wanting to smear his name if I was wrong. Sam shakes his head.
That son of a bitch traitor. It must have been him who told the Mogs about Chicago.
One of your own, Adam says quietly. That is unexpected.
I have to look away from Five's image before my blood boils.
You didn't know about this?
I ask Adam through clenched teeth.
No,
he says, shaking his head.
I would have told you. Cetricus Ra himself must have been keeping him a secret.
I force myself to look back at the screen. I keep calm, studying my new enemy. His slumped shoulders, his freshly shaved head, the dark look in his remaining eye. What could have brought one of our own to such a terrible place?
I knew there was something off about that jerk, Sam says, pacing now. John, man, what are we gonna do about him?
I don't reply, mainly because the only solution I can think of at that moment, seeing Five in the enemy's uniform, is to kill him.
Where's he going?
Follow him, I tell Adam. Adam does. The camera follows Five across the runway until he reaches a ramp that leads onto the biggest spaceship I've ever seen, so massive that its entire bulk isn't even picked up on camera.
Damn, I breathe, my eyes widening. What the hell is that thing?
Warship,
Adam answers, a note of awe sneaking into his voice as he squints at the screen.
I can't tell which one.
Which one? Sam exclaims. How many of those things do they have?
Dozens. Maybe more, maybe less. They run on the old fuel of Mogador and whatever my people managed to mine from Lorien. Not the most efficient things. And slow. When I got in trouble as a boy, my mother would threaten to ground me until the fleet's arrival.
He realizes he's rambling and trails off, looking up at us.
You don't care about this, do you?
Maybe not the best time for reminiscing, I reply, watching as Five boards the ship. But what else can you tell us about the fleet?
They've been traveling since the fall of Lorien, Adam continues. Moog strategists believe they've got enough firepower left for one last siege.
Earth, I say.
Yeah,
Adam replies.
Then my people will settle here. Maybe rebuild the fleet if Cetricus Ra finds a reason.
You mean if there's any life in the universe left for him to conquer? I say. Sam shakes his head, still marveling at the hulking warship.
So they have a secret weakness, right? Like how you can shoot that one spot on the Death Star and the whole thing blows up?
Adam's brow furrows.
What's a Death Star?
Sam throws up his hands.
We're screwed!
If they've been taken prisoner and are aboard that thing. I don't finish the thought, mainly because a course of action just isn't coming to me. Taking over a mostly abandoned Mogadorian base is one thing. Finding a way aboard a massive warship is another entirely. Especially when that massive warship is slowly rising into the sky. Maybe Sam's right and we are screwed. The three of us watch in silence as the warship climbs. Before it's entirely off screen, the ship's carapace flickers, and the whole thing disappears from view. Well, not entirely. The ship's outline is still vaguely visible, as if the light around it is bending in strange ways. The distortion is almost like trying to focus on an object that's underwater.
Cloaking, Adam says. All of the warships have it.
Hey, look at the tablet, Sam says. Maybe everything isn't totally depressing.
As the now invisible warship floats upward, one of the dots on the tablet slowly pulls away from the others. Five's dot. After a few seconds, it begins to flicker erratically across the screen. We've now got two guard indicators bouncing spastically over the map.
Just like Ella, Sam says, furrowing his brow.
The warship must be returning to orbit, Adam says, which means...
Ella is already aboard one of those things. I finish the thought. They brought her up to the fleet.
How are we going to get up there? Sam asks.
We won't have to, Adam responds. The fleet will come to us.
Oh, right, Sam says. Worldwide invasion. So we're planning to just wait for that?
I tap my finger on the tablet, pointing out the three dots still in Florida. The plan is to get the others. They're still there. We just have to... I stop myself when I look back at the screen. The runway is starting to move. I thought you disabled the ship. Why are they moving? With a hurried series of keystrokes, Adam cranes the camera down. From this angle, we can see the crew of Mogadorians grimacing as they push the scout vessel manually towards the hangar.
I guess they gave up on getting it started, Sam observes.
One of the Mogs runs ahead to slide open the metal doors, and there, caught out in the middle of the empty hangar, are Nine, Marina, and Six. Sam lets loose an excited shout that he cuts off quickly, the harsh math sinking in, that there are three guard where there should be four, and that Nine is carrying in his arms what is obviously a body bag.
Eight. Sam says, swallowing. Shit.
I turn to Adam, not ready to grieve yet.
Does this ship you've hacked have any guns?
Chapter 14. After a barrage of near-deafening blaster fire in the wide-open space of the hangar, the scout ship goes eerily silent. Marina and I crouch next to each other, both of us huddled behind the flipped-over metal table. We exchange a look. The table didn't sustain even a single shot of blaster fire. In fact, it doesn't seem like the ship's turret came even close to hitting us. "Nice aim, dipshit!" Nine shouts, laughing. He's off to the side of the table, flat on the ground, half-shielding Eight's body with his own. I poke my head out from behind the table. Between us and the scout vessel are a dozen piles of ash, formerly the Mogadorian mechanics. The ship's gun turret is still smoking, but hangs dormant now. Not the least bit interested in us. Cautiously, I stand up. Marina joins me. What the hell is going on? I ask. Who cares? Nine says, hefting Eight's body. Let's get out of here. Perhaps some kind of malfunction? Marina proposes, inching closer to the ship, which still blocks our way out. The three of us spread out, making sure not to stand directly in the path of the blaster. It only shot the Moogs, I say. That's one convenient malfunction. All three of us jump when the ship's cockpit opens up with a hydraulic hiss. There's a burst of static from a speaker in the cockpit, and then a familiar voice rings out. Guys, can you hear me? John? I exclaim, not believing my ears. The last time I saw him, he was in a coma along with Ella. I sprint to the ship and jump onto its front end, standing over the open cockpit to better hear his voice. It's me, Six, John says. It's good to see you. See me? I ask, then notice the small camera mounted over the cockpit entrance. It wiggles back and forth, almost nodding in greeting. Dude, what happened? Nine asks, eyeing the cockpit skeptically. Is your brain, like, trapped in a Mogadorian ship now? What? No! Don't be an idiot, John replies, and I can picture the look of annoyed amusement on his face. We've taken over a Mogadorian base and used their tech to hack into this ship. Nice! Nine replies, like that's all he needed to hear. He jumps effortlessly onto the ship's hood, still holding Eight, and lands right beside me. Our side of the saucer-shaped vessel dips a little at his weight before righting itself, the landing gear whining. Nine kicks the metal hull with his heel, testing it out. So, this is our ride? In answer, the ship's engine begins to vibrate beneath our feet. I look down into the cockpit. There are six hard plastic seats in there, along with a blinking dashboard covered in random Mogadorian symbols and a set of controls that look similar to what you'd find on an airplane. Not that I've ever flown one of those before, much less one made by Mogadorians. We saw what happened in Chicago, Marina says, also climbing onto the ship. Is everyone all right? Yeah, John replies quickly, then seems to reconsider. They took Ella. But I don't think she's in danger yet. Marina's eyebrows shoot up in alarm, and I can feel the cold start to roll off her. What do you mean they took her? I'll explain everything when you get in the air, John says. First, let's get you out of there. Sounds good, Nine replies, and hops down into the cockpit, gently placing Eight's body across a couple of the seats. John, one problem? I say, following Nine into the antiseptic-smelling Moog ship. How are we supposed to fly this thing? There's a pause on John's end, and then a different voice responds, this one with a harsh accent that makes my shoulders tense. I could fly you remotely, but I'm worried hacking into the ship's computer might have damaged some of the auto-navigation protocols. It'll be safer if you do it manually with me walking you through it, the Mogadorian explains quickly. Then, as if realizing we might be freaked out, the guy adds, Hey, I'm Adam. The guy Malcolm told us about, I say, remembering that dinner conversation. Don't worry, Six, Sam's voice interjects, and I can't help but grin at the sound of it. He's totally not evil. Oh, well, in that case, let's fly, Nine says sarcastically. But settles into one of the hard-backed plastic seats all the same. I hop into the pilot's chair. Marina hesitates for a moment, giving the console where the Moog's voice came from a look of distrust. How do we know that's really John? She asks. Cetricus Ra can change forms. This might be some kind of trap. In my excitement to hear John and Sam, I hadn't even considered the possibility that this could be a ploy. Behind me, Nine shouts towards the communicator. Hey, Johnny, remember back in Chicago when you were claiming to be Pittacus Lore and we had a debate about whether to go to New Mexico? Yeah. John's voice sounds like it's coming through clenched teeth. How'd we settle that? John sighs. You dangled me off the edge of the roof. Nine grins like that's the best thing ever. It's definitely him. Marina, John says, probably thinking Nine's little test wasn't good enough. The first time we met, you healed two bullet wounds in my ankle, and then we almost got hit by a missile. A small smile forms on Marina's face, the first I've seen in days. I thought you were about the coolest guy I'd ever met, John Smith. Nine barks out a laugh at that, shaking his head. Marina climbs aboard, taking a seat next to Eight's body. She drapes a hand protectively on the body bag and settles in. Watch your heads, Adam warns as the cockpit hisses closed above us. There's a moment where I feel a sense of panic at being sealed inside a Mogadorian ship. But I shove that feeling down and tightly clutch the steering apparatus. It's dim in the cockpit, the glass having a tinted sunglasses-like look. Streams of data and compressed Mogadorian symbols are projected directly onto the glass, the readout something only a Mog pilot could make sense of. All right, I say. What now? Hold up, Nine interjects, leaning forward. How come you get to drive? Adam's voice comes through clear, patient, but authoritative. Turn the wheel in front of you. That will rotate the ship. I do as he instructs, the wheel turning easily, the saucer portion of the ship doing a 180 without the wheels moving at all. I stop turning when we're pointed towards the hangar's exit. Good, Adam says. Now, the lever on your left moves the wheels. I grip the lever and push it just a tad. The ship jerks forward almost immediately. The controls are sensitive, and it doesn't take much pressure to get us slowly rolling out onto the runway. Give it some gas, Six. Damn, Nine complains. Drive it like we stole it. Don't listen to him, Marina says, hugging herself. If you're out from under the hangar, you can stop, Adam instructs. I look up through the glass of the cockpit, see only sky, and so let go of the lever. The ship creaks to a stop. Okay, Adam says. Now, grasp the wheel in front of you at 3 and 9. Do you feel the triggers? I take the wheel again and feel around for the two buttons indented in its underside. Got 'em, I reply, testing out the trigger on the left by squeezing it. As soon as I do, the vibration from the ship's engine reaches a bone-rattling crescendo and we rise into the air. Oh, shit! Nine yells. Next to me, Marina squeezes herself a little tighter, closing her eyes. Be careful, Six, she whispers. I let go of the button, and the ship effortlessly maintains its elevation. We're hovering about 20 yards off the ground. You weren't supposed to do that yet, Adam admonishes. Yeah, sorry. First time flying a spaceship. I reply. No big deal, Adam replies. The trigger on your left increases your elevation. The one on your right decreases it. Left up, right down. Got it. Also, Adam says, you're in what my people call a skimmer. It isn't built for interplanetary travel, so it isn't quite a spaceship. Nine makes a loud snoring noise. Is this dude about to give us a lesson in Mogadorian aviation or something? The hell? You know I can hear you, right? Adam replies over the mic. And no, I am not. Sorry about Nine, I say, giving him a dirty look over my shoulder. Does this thing come with ejector seats? Yes, actually, Adam replies. Whoa, now! Nine says, edging forward so his butt isn't entirely on the seat. Don't get any ideas, Six. I shush Nine when I hear a series of clanking noises emanating from the ship's underbelly. What is that? I ask. Don't worry, Adam replies. I just remotely put up your landing gear. When the clanking finishes, two small panels on the steering wheel slide aside, revealing thumb-sized buttons positioned so they can be pressed at the same time as the elevation triggers. You should see a couple of buttons, Adam continues. Depress them to accelerate. Simply let them go to brake. I grip the steering wheel more tentatively than before, and gently squeeze the buttons, careful not to hit the trigger on the wheel's underside. The skimmer zips forward, and then lurches to a stop when I let the button go. It's like a video game, Nine says, leaning over the back of my chair. Any idiot could work this thing. No offense, Moog guy. None taken. I press down the accelerator a little more forcefully, and the ship shoots forward. A diagnostic on the screen starts flashing, a warning in any language, right before I scrape the bottom of the skimmer against the top of a tree. I hear branches breaking and, craning my neck, see them hit the ground below. Oops, I say and glance sidelong at Marina. Six, I swear, she says, flashing me a half-panicked look. You'll want to get some more elevation, Adam says, and, consider steering. Nine laughs and leans back. I pull the trigger for vertical, and we rise up higher. As we clear the dense trees of the swampland, the horizon becomes visible. A laser-fine dotted line appears on the cockpit glass, superimposed over the view, like a trail. I've plotted your course, Adam says. Just follow the line. I nod and give the ship some juice, following the laser path north. All right, boys, I say. Here we come. The flight from Florida to Washington takes about 2 hours. On Adam's instructions, I keep our altitude low enough that we won't be picked up on satellites or accidentally cross paths with any airplanes, but high enough that there won't be a rash of UFO sightings along the eastern seaboard. Although, considering how serious the threat of all-out Mogadorian invasion seems, maybe we should let our stolen ship be seen. Shoot off some fireworks. Warn the locals. After the initial rush of elation at hearing John and Sam, at knowing our friends are alive, the conversation turns grim. Over the radio, they describe what went down at the John Hancock Center. After that, John tells us about what he saw in the nightmare vision he shared with Ella, and why he thinks Cetricus Ra doesn't want to hurt her. John's pieced together a theory that Ella could be related to Cetricus Ra, and that the Mogadorian ruler could actually be some kind of twisted Lorik, the banished elder mentioned in Creighton's letter. I'm not ready to grapple with that yet. Once John's caught us up, it's our turn to fill in the others on what happened in Florida. Even over the radio, I can tell John's trying not to press us too much. I think about the days that John's been living with a fresh scar on his ankle, wondering which one of us wouldn't be making it back. As much as it hurts to talk about, he deserves to know what happened to Eight. However, neither Marina nor Nine are very forthcoming, so it falls to me to describe how Five betrayed us, how he murdered Eight, technically by accident, but only because he was actually trying to murder Nine. I was unconscious for most of the fight, so I keep the description bare bones, just the facts, not sugarcoating anything. Then I give them the details of rescuing Eight's body from the Mogadorian encampment, and tell them about what Five did to his Mogadorian pal. When I'm finished, a grim mood settles inside the cockpit, and we ride in silence until we reach suburban D.C. I land the ship in the middle of a basketball court. We're in a fancy-ass suburban development, one made extraordinarily eerie by all its darkened windows and general emptiness. The cockpit opens for us, and Marina flashes me a relieved look as she stands up. Carefully, Nine picks up Eight's body and climbs out of the ship. Marina stays close to him, her hand on Nine's elbow, making sure that Eight doesn't get jostled too much. It's still hard to believe that's our friend in that body bag. It feels wrong to be carrying him around so much. "Your travels are almost over," I overhear Marina whisper to Eight's body. She must feel the same as I do. Marina and I hop down to the ground and turn around to help Nine lower Eight's body. Instead of passing Eight down, Nine squints into the darkness around us. "Whoa," he says. "There are, like, some random creatures watching us right now." "Creatures?" I reply, looking up at him. Nine's expression has gone blank, well, blanker than usual, the way he gets when he's using his animal telepathy. "Oh, I forgot to mention, we found some new friends." It's John, jogging towards us from the crooked doorway of a house that looks half-smashed, like the ground tried to swallow it up but couldn't quite finish. Sam is a few steps behind him, beaming at me, although when he notices me noticing him, he quickly tones down the wattage of his smile, going for something a little less eager. Behind John and Sam, pushing a gurney, are Malcolm and a pale, lanky guy that I assume must be Adam, the dark hair hanging in his face making him look half Moog and half emo rock star. "So many Chimerae," Nine says, nodding excitedly as he gazes out into the darkness. "That's awesome." "We named the chubby, lazy one after you," Sam replies.
"Less awesome."
Upon reaching us, John wraps Marina in a tight hug. It's dark out, but I can see days of worry etched in the dark bags under his eyes. I remember that wide-eyed kid I found fighting Mogadorians at his high school, and wonder if John felt like that again, like he was back to being alone against the world. It should be a relief that we're reunited, but we're one less. And I know John well enough to know that he's been beating himself up over our loss for days. "You made it," John says as he lets Marina go and hugs me next. His voice is quiet, for me only. I didn't know what I was going to do if... "You don't have to say anything," I reply, squeezing him back. "We're here now. We're going to fight. We're going to win." John takes a step back from me, a relieved look briefly passing across his face, like he needed someone to tell him that. He nods to me and then walks over to the ship, taking Eight's body in his arms so that Nine can jump down. Everyone falls silent as Malcolm wheels the gurney toward me so that John can set down the body. "The Moogs put something on him," Marina says. She takes a lurching step towards the gurney. "Some electrical field." Adam takes a tentative step forward and clears his throat. "Electrodes? Over the heart? On the temples?" "Yes," Marina replies without looking at Adam, her eyes fixed on Eight's body bag. "The Moogs use that to, Adam pauses, then finishes awkwardly. "To keep specimens fresh. It won't harm the remains, just preserve them." "Specimens," Nine repeats dryly. "I'm sorry about your friend," Adam says quietly, pushing a hand through his hair. "I just thought you should know." "It's all right." "Thanks, Adam," John says. He puts a hand on Marina's shoulder. "Come on. Let's get him inside."
"What?"
Marina chokes up and has to take a deep breath.
"What are you going to do with him?"
"We've set aside a quiet room inside," Malcolm replies gently. "I'm not sure what customs the Lorik have for burials." I look first at John, whose face is scrunched up in thought, Then at 9, who looks absolutely baffled. We don't know them either, I say. I mean, when was the last time we had a chance to properly honor one of our fallen? We can't bury him here, though, Marina says. This is a Moog place. Malcolm nods, understanding, and touches Marina softly on the shoulder.
Do you want to help me bring him inside?
Marina nods. Together, she and Malcolm wheel 8's body back towards the sunken house. Adam follows them at a respectful distance, his hands clasped awkwardly behind his back. After a moment, 9 claps John hard on the back, breaking the tension.
So, did I mishear over the communicator? Or did you send your girlfriend off on a super sexy secret mission with her ex-boyfriend?
We're fighting a war here, 9. It's not a joke, John replies sternly. After a moment's awkward pause, a begrudging smile breaks on his face.
Also, shut up. It's not super sexy.
What does that even mean?
Wow, you really need my guidance, 9 says.
He throws his arm around John's shoulders and leads him towards the house.
Come on, I'll explain what sexy is.
I know what... Ugh, why am I even discussing this with you? John shoves 9 in frustration, but 9 just holds on tighter.
Get off me, idiot! Come on, Johnny, you need my affection now more than ever.
I roll my eyes as the guys walk towards the house, having their little bro moment. That leaves me alone with Sam, standing a few feet away, looking at me intently. I can see him trying to figure out what to say, or more likely working up the nerve to say it. The guy's probably been chewing on this moment for hours, working on his amazing speech to the girl he wasn't sure he'd ever see again.
Hey,
is what he settles on at last. Hey back, I reply, and before he can get another word out, I wrap my arms around him and kiss him hard enough that I probably knock the wind out of him. Sam seems stunned at first, but kisses back after a moment, trying to match my intensity. I grab him by the front of the shirt and pull him so that we're pressed up against the side of the skimmer. Not exactly the most romantic place in the world, but I'll take it. I grab Sam's hands and put them on my hips, then clutch the sides of his face and run my fingers up through his hair, all this desperate energy pouring out of me and into this kiss. After a couple of minutes, Sam breaks away from me, breathless.
6, whoa. What is going on?
The look on Sam's face isn't what I was expecting. Yes, there's flushed bewilderment, but mixed in with that surprise is an undercurrent of concern. It makes me look away. I just really wanted to do that, I reply, telling him the truth. I didn't know if I'd get another chance. I press my face against the side of Sam's neck and feel his heartbeat against my cheek. I've spent the last few days putting on a strong front, trying to keep it together with Marina and 9 both on the verge of falling apart. Finally, at least while we're out here in the dark, I can let myself go a little bit. Sam has me around the waist, so I sink against him. Let him hold me up and take a shuddering breath against his neck.
It can just end so quickly, I whisper, leaning back to get a look at him. I didn't want to not have done that, you know?
I don't care if it complicates things.
Me neither, Sam says. Obviously.
We start to kiss again, this time a lot gentler, Sam's hands slowly moving up my sides. When the wolf howls, loud, echoing nearby, my first instinct is that it's 9 spying on us from the house and making stupid noises. But then a second and third wolf make a howling chorus, and I lean back to peer at Sam.
What the hell is that? I ask. Wolves in the suburbs?
I don't know, he starts to reply, but then his eyes widen.
The Chimerae. They're warning us.
A moment after he says it, I hear the whoop, whoop, whoop of at least 3 helicopters bearing down on us. If I squint, I can see their outlines approaching in the night sky. And then there are the blue flashing lights coming from the housing development's only access road. The lights are attached to a caravan of black SUVs, all of them speeding in our direction.
Chapter 15. At the sound of screeching tires and helicopter rotors, Nine and I burst back outside, leaping over the house's broken porch and onto the lawn. We're just in time to see a lightning strike slice down from the sky, courtesy of Six. It's a warning shot. The bolt erupts a piece of asphalt right in front of a black SUV that's careening up the access road, causing it to swerve.
"The hell is this?" Nine growls. "I thought we were done with the feds."
"Adam said they're supposed to leave this place alone," I reply. "Some deal with the Moogs."
"I guess that ended when you killed them all, huh?"
There are 3 choppers overhead, circling like vultures. Some signal must pass between them, because they all turn on spotlights at the same time. One of them trains on me and Nine, another on the entrance of the house behind us, and a third on Six and Sam. In the bright light, I notice Sam, unarmed, quickly climbing into the skimmer for cover. Six, her hands splayed in the air, in the process of summoning some nasty weather for our uninvited guests, goes invisible before the spotlight can really get a fix on her. Meanwhile, undeterred by the lightning strike, a parade of black SUVs files up the access road, blue lights flashing beneath their windshields. They skid to a stop next to each other in a tight formation, eventually creating a blockade of bulletproof glass and shiny, dent-resistant paneling. Their doors fling open, and a bunch of agents in identical navy blue windbreakers leap out. The ones who aren't yelling into walkie-talkies have guns trained on us. All of them hunkered behind their car doors for cover. It takes them less than a minute to have us pinned down in the cul-de-sac.
"Do they really think this will stop us?"
Nine asks as he takes a step away from the house, almost daring the agents to try shooting him. "I don't know what they're thinking," I reply. "But they don't know about the Chimerae." I can sense them lurking in the shadows just off the access road. These government guys might think they've got us surrounded, but the glowing eyes in the darkness would argue otherwise. The Chimerae hold their position, waiting for a signal. I hear a creak behind me, and half turn to find Marina on the porch, jagged icicles extending from her hands like twin daggers. That's new. Next to her, using the doorway for cover, is Adam, holding a Mogadorian blaster.
"What do we do?"
Marina asks. I notice storm clouds gathering overhead. Six is ready to throw down if we need to. But so far, the government guys haven't done anything except make a lot of noise. They didn't come in shooting, which is the only reason I haven't fired up my lumen. "I don't want to hurt them if we don't have to," I say. "But we don't have time for any bullshit. I'm damn sure not being taken in for questioning." Apparently, Nine interprets my words as encouragement to do something crazy. He strides forward and picks up the base of Dr. Anu's chair, which got sheared in half by blaster fire during this afternoon's battle. The thing must weigh close to 200 pounds, but Nine hefts it easily with one hand, swinging it back and forth as a demonstration.
"You guys are on private property," Nine shouts, "and I don't see any warrants."
Before I can stop him, Nine flings the entire chunk into the air, putting it just inches from the nose of the nearest helicopter. It's pretty obvious from my vantage point that the chopper isn't in any real danger, but I guess the human pilot isn't used to having super strong guard chucking scrap metal at him. The pilot pulls back on his controls, and the chopper shakily gains altitude, its spotlight making erratic trails across the lawn. The chair piece comes down with a loud crash in the middle of the street.
That was unnecessary,
Adam observes from the doorway.
Agree to disagree,
Nine says. As he bends down to pick up another piece of the chair, I hear the telltale cocking of guns from the line of SUVs. Six must hear them too, from wherever she's lurking, because a wave of fog suddenly rolls across the lawns of Ashwood Estates, making us much harder to target. I light my lumen and step forward, putting myself between Nine and the SUVs. I hold up my hands so the agents can clearly see that they're enveloped in fire.
I don't know why you're here,
I yell towards the line of cars, but you're making a mistake. This is a fight you seriously cannot win. Smartest thing you can do is go back to your bosses and tell them there was nothing here. To punctuate the speech, I send a telepathic command to our chimerae. Howls ring out from the darkness on the SUV's flanks. Suddenly panicked, some of the agents start aiming their guns into the shadows, and one of the choppers uses its spotlight to begin combing the fields alongside the access road. We've got them scared.
Last warning,
I shout, letting a basketball-sized fireball float up from my palm.
Jesus Christ,
a woman's voice shouts from the line of cars. Everybody stand down. One by one, the agents at the cars lower their weapons. As they do, one of them squeezes between a pair of SUVs and walks towards us, her hands raised in surrender. Through the fog, I recognize her rigid posture and severe ponytail.
Agent Walker, is that you?
Next to me, Nine laughs.
Oh, come on! You gonna try arresting us again?
Walker grimaces as she gets closer, her sharp features more lined than I remember. She's pale, an alarming streak of gray running through her red hair. I try to remember how badly she was hurt back at Dulce Base. Could she still be feeling the effects of that? Before she can get too close, Six manifests behind Walker and grabs her by the ponytail.
Not another step, she snarls.
Walker, eyes wide, obediently, stops. Six reaches down and takes the gun off her hip, dropping it into the grass.
I'm sorry for the commotion,
Walker says, her voice slightly strangled thanks to the angle Six has her head at.
My agent saw that Mogadorian ship land, and we thought you might be under attack.
I let the lumen in my hands go out, tilting my head at her. Wait, you came rushing in here because you thought we were under attack?
I know you have no reason to believe me,
Walker says, her voice hoarse.
But we're here to help.
Next to me, Nine scoffs. I stare hard at Walker, waiting for the punchline, or the secret signal for her men to open fire.
Please,
she says,
just hear me out.
I sigh and motion towards the house. Bring her in, I tell Six, then turn to Nine. If the rest of them try anything even a little suspicious, Nine cracks his knuckles.
Oh, I know what to do.
Six shoves Walker up the broken steps of Adam's house and through the front door. I follow a few steps behind, leaving the rest of our friends to keep an eye on the small army of government agents.
Is that a Mogadorian I saw out there?
Walker asks as Six pushes her into the living room.
You have one of them prisoner?
He's an ally, I say. Right now, you're the prisoner.
Understood,
Walker says, sounding more tired than anything. Without Six having to push her, Walker sits down heavily on one of the sofas. In the light of the living room, I can see that there's definitely something off about her. Maybe it's owing to the odd streak of gray in her hair, but Walker looks drained. She notices the entrance to the Mogadorian tunnels, but doesn't look particularly interested or surprised.
Ah, guest, Malcolm says as he appears in the doorway between the living room and the kitchen, his rifle slung over his shoulder. And she brought lots of friends. Is everything all right?
I'm not sure yet. I reply, an edge to my voice, keeping my guard up. Six circles around the couch so she can stand where Walker can't see her.
Hmm, Malcolm says.